I don't see that we've got an end to rising interest rates. I don't see we've got an end to rising bond yields. And that being the case, even if this current hiatus in the banking system is smoothed over, there are going to be more hiatuses. There are going to be more crises along the way, because what we've come out of, in effect, is a massive bubble. This is a bubble, and they're trying to sustain the bubble. And that's not going to work. And the problem is that if you have a bubble which is at the behest of government agencies, then they're going to just destroy their currencies.
This is Kaiser Johnson with Liberty and Finance, and this is the Miles Franklin Weekly Special for March 14th through March 21st, 2023, while supplies last. This week we feature the silver Krugerrand at $3.79 over spot. For years, the Krugerrand was the most known bullion coin in the world, and in 2017, the South African Mint and Rand Refinery began minting a silver counterpart to the famed gold Krugerrand. The silver Krugerrand bear the Springbok on one side and the portrait of Paul Kruger on the other, and have a face value of 1 rand. They come 25 to a tube, 500 to a monster box, they are IRA eligible, and are renowned for recognizability and design. Best of all, they are only $3.79 over spot while supplies last. To order this special or any of the many other options we have available, call us at 1-888-81-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-815-4237. We're available after hours and on weekends, and we look forward to speaking with you.
Welcome back to Liberty and Finance. We're always privileged to have this distinguished returning guest, Alastair MacLeod, a former bank president and now the head of research at goldmoney.com, joins us this Tuesday, March 14th, 2023. Alastair, thanks for coming back on Liberty and Finance.
That's my pleasure, DK. Thank you for having me.
You have been a regular attendee here, and our viewers have been tuning in to watch you give us a play-by-play progression of events that have been building towards a climax of enormous proportions in challenges in not only the banking sector, but also in the fiat currencies worldwide. And we've seen a very eventful weekend here in the U.S., three banks being shuttered, two of them being in the second and third largest banks ever failed in the U.S., and the government taking extraordinary measures, reversing their position on, we're not going to bail you out. Okay, we are going to bail you out, but the taxpayers aren't going to pay for it. And definite acknowledgement from officialdom that they are trying to stem the potential of a systemic banking collapse. You've been warning us about such risks for some time now. We'd really like to get your expert opinion on what is actually happening here and whether you believe that this is the sign of more to come, or a one-off event, and now it'll be back to sleep for a while until the real thing happens. So could you kind of walk us through your assessment of the current situation and what you think is ahead?
Sure. Well, I wish it was back to sleep and stop worrying about it, but I'm afraid that that would be wrong. One question was answered, and that is, do they bail in or bail out? Very quickly, the bail-in was dropped, and we're going back to bailout. And interestingly, the Fed has turned around and tried to deal with the losses that banks, and I think they're particularly aiming at the, if you like, the regional banks, the losses that the regional banks have accumulated on their bond investments. I mean, this was the thing about Silicon Valley Bank, I think roughly, is it $70 billion worth of their assets were invested in US Treasury stock, agency stock, and similarly highly rated stuff. The problem is that quite a lot of that was long dated. They bought it when interest rates were pegged at zero or close to zero. And now we're looking at 4.75%, possibly even going up again this week. It created a run inevitably on that bank, and I mean there are an enormous number of banks in this position. If you look at the Fed's H4 schedule, that shows I think something like $4.5 trillion. Of U.S. Treasury debt on the commercial banks balance sheets in total, and another two and a half trillion, something like that, in agency debt. So we're looking actually at enormous numbers potentially involved here. And what is interesting is that the way the Fed has tried to deal with this is by opening up a new program, which it calls the Bank Term Funding Program, whereby doesn't matter what the coupon is, doesn't matter what the maturity is, it will take it all in at face value and pay you out. And you have that money for a year. So what I just wonder, I mean, you know, lovely. Okay, that stabilizes the system for the moment. But what I wonder about this is, what are the other banks going to do? I mean, if I was running a bank and I had some of this stuff on my balance sheet, I would just say, right, gimme. You know, I would say to the Fed, yeah, thank you very much indeed. You can have my whole portfolio. And then with that, I can do either of two things. I can either go out and lend it because I've now got balance sheet space. I can lend it to someone else, create credit for someone else. Or alternatively, I just leave it at the Fed. Or there's a third alternative. If I do actually believe this whole thing is transient, then I go into the market and buy stuff at a substantial discount, having sold it all at par. So in other words, I do a bear operation. But the problem the Fed has with this is that all this stuff which they bought for a year, I mean, when the year is up, they're going to roll it. I mean, there's no way they're going to turn around and say, right, you know, time's up, lads. You know, you've got to get your stock back. I want the money back. I mean, no. Have they been able to do that with QE? QT? No. No. I mean, you know, there's quantitative tightening because this is actually what it is. It is expanding the Fed's balance sheet massively. It could potentially almost double it if you look at the numbers on that H4 form. I don't think it'll be quite that bad. But this is, I think, a means of kicking the can down the road, which is going to come back and bite them very, very badly. Because all the monetary inflation that's involved, the credit inflation that's involved at the Fed level as opposed to the commercial bank level, I think will just destroy the currency. That is the risk. So what, I mean, basically, putting it in a nutshell, the thing we didn't know for certain, would the Fed choose to protect the financial system or to protect the currency? We now know the answer. They're choosing to protect the financial system. Oh, what a surprise. So that's where we are. And in terms of, does this deal with the crisis? No, it doesn't deal with the crisis. It deals with one aspect of the crisis. But the other aspect of the crisis, which I think is desperately important, is the position of banks in other jurisdictions. I mean, we've seen Credit Suisse sink to a new low. Why? Because depositors have been getting out of their deposits, moving their deposits to other banks. And this raises the other problem, which I think very few people really understand, and that is that the way in which a bank deals with a shortfall or an excess on its liability side is it goes into the market and buys or sells money in order to balance its balance sheet. So if you get deposits running out of a bank, then you've got to go in and borrow to make up the deficiency in the wholesale money markets. That is what the you know, the money markets are all about. We're not talking about clearing. Clearing is a different thing. We're just talking about keeping the balance sheets balanced, if you like. Now, what happens is, just imagine, Credit Suisse approaches your bank or your dealers in through the money market and says, we want to borrow 10 million Swissy. What do you do? I think you turn around and say, I don't think I want to do that. No. So you find that banks in that position get these lines closed off to them. And the only thing an outfit like Credit Suisse can do is effectively go to its national central bank and get liquidity accommodation from there, which is a very bad sign. It is generally recognized that that is your last resort. And if you're doing that, then you know, you are in trouble. You are in deep trouble. So I think generally what's happening, and we've seen a little bit of this. I mean, the LIBOR OIS spread has widened from something like 25 basis points to 130 basis points. But I don't think even that tells us the whole story, because you know, it's not just you know, at what level does LIBOR change hands compared with the riskless spread rate, which is what OIS is. Is the credit actually available? Because if you say, you know, no, I'm not going to deal, that's not recorded as a price. It's no deal. So you've got a contraction in the wholesale money markets to consider, as well as depositors running out of the door of this bank or that bank or whatever it might be. So I think the answer to your question is that we have seen Act One in an ongoing tragedy.
I wanted to zoom in on maybe three different aspects of what you talked about. One was this, you said it's one of the worst things that can be seen, is a bank having to go to its central bank because the other banks don't want to lend to it. So let's talk about that, this sort of this psyops, this managing of sentiment that's being attempted. We have Biden and Yellen and others saying, see, this wasn't so bad. We got this all under control. Don't worry, we got this taken care of. That's about the time that most people who have a little bit of experience under their belt start to get really concerned, because when those in power are busy telling you not to worry, there's usually a reason they're telling you not to worry. We saw that leaked video from the FDIC came out about a month or two ago talking about there are going to be bank failures. There are going to be runs on the bank. We don't want to publicize this because there would be unintended consequences if the public were to know that. So let's only inform the most well-connected money managers and that sort of thing, those in the highest positions, and not inform the general public. And yet, here we have this apparently new facility having to be created, which is being spun as a good thing. See how responsible we are as the government to take good care of you in times of concern. Now you don't need to be concerned, rather than, oh my gosh, if the government and the feds had to spin up a whole new facility to take care of this problem to prevent a systemic contagion, perhaps that's an indication that's the opposite of what they're telling us psychologically, that this is actually quite a serious situation, and they felt that they had to take extraordinary measures to tamp it down. That's number one. And I don't know if you want to respond to that, then I could go on to the other couple of points that I had.
You know, basically, the Fed had to act very, very quickly to try and stop the slide in sentiment, because, you know, what we have is credit. We're dealing in credit, and credit depends on confidence in the repayment of that credit, or the, you know, the transaction being closed at the end of the day. And that credit has got to have value, and the value is really in the counterparty and also in what the credit is denominated. So, if the confidence in the banking system slides, then, you know, this is curtains for the whole of the credit side of an economy. It cannot be permitted to happen. And this is why they very quickly moved from bail-in to back to good old-fashioned bailout. I mean, you know, the FDIC turning, you know, its first statement was, well, you know, as long as you've got no more than $250,000 in your bank account, you will be protected. After that, go fish. You know, that lasted what? Hardly 48 hours.
Not through the weekend, yes.
No, mm-hmm. Exactly. Because they very quickly realized, that, you know, they had shouts of anger and all the rest of it. They very quickly realized that, you know, this is completely impractical. I mean, we may think this is dishonest, immoral, whatever, but the primary function of a central bank is to ensure the integrity of the commercial banking system. It cannot risk that. It's actually as simple as that. So this is why, you know, bail-ins were a very, very dangerous idea, and it wasn't going to go anywhere. And we've seen that it's the whole idea, all the legislation that was passed by 20-odd jurisdictions in the wake of the G20 meeting in, I can't remember where it was, 2008, I think it was, you know, when the bail-in thing was first proposed. You know, that's just out the window now. And anyone who tries it, you know, is going to just topple the whole global financial system. I mean, you know, just forget it. It's just complete nonsense. The other thing I'd like to say about the size of this Fed program, they said that they've got a facility of $25 billion from the Exchange Stabilization Fund, $25 billion. Now, hold on a minute. The entire commercial banking network has got, as I said earlier, somewhere between, I don't know, $7 and $7.5 trillion of these securities. And I think it's a fair bet that at least 90% of them are underwater. And so, you know, what do you do? I mean, the answer is quite simple. You give it to the Fed. The Fed gives you money. And if you're really quite bullish about things, you don't think inflation is a real problem, and you're actually totally supportive of the Fed and financial markets and all the rest of it, then you can go into the market and you can buy the same stock, probably at a 30% discount to what you sold it at the Fed. You know, so do we really think that banks are going to stand back and say, well, you know, we're not going to take this opportunity? Oh, come on, I really don't see it. I just don't see it.
Another phenomenon is the trading behavior around crises like this. We saw yesterday on the major exchanges, 30 banks had to halt trading because their shares were dropping beyond limits, that sort of thing. So there clearly was a rush by the crowd of investors out of many, many banks. And then a statement came yesterday from Morgan Stanley's top investment strategist and the CIO in a note reported by Bloomberg on Monday. And that is, we suggest selling any bounces on a government intervention to quell the immediate liquidity crisis as SVB and other institutions until they make new bear market lows at a minimum. That's from Mike Wilson, Morgan Stanley's chief U.S. equity strategist and CIO. So here you have a really large bank saying, sell any rallies, sell any bounces on these banks. And that is a very interesting phenomenon, because you always have to look at this. Why is this person saying that? Are they, in fact, to the public? By the time the advice comes to the public, is it by that time a bash and stash operation where there's a bargain sweeping up at auction discounts by these other larger banks to consolidate at low prices assets from the smaller banks? We certainly saw such a consolidation of power during the last 3 years of lockdowns and everything, where the largest retailers, for example, big name, you know, Walmarts, Costcos, everybody, Amazons, got selected as winners, and all the mom and pop shops got selected as losers to be culled during this huge time of transition where there's this consolidation of power and of market share. Do you see that as a phenomenon that's likely to play out during these waves of crisis around banking stability or instability, is a consolidation of power with failures being permitted for small and regional banks and assets being bought up at a bargain fire sale by the largest banks while telling the public, sell any rally?
We can't really know the answer to this. And of course, it's easy to assume that an outfit like Morgan Stanley, a very powerful bank, is creating an opportunity for it to acquire banks for, you know, like SLV UK Limited was acquired for £1 by HSBC. I mean, I can't say that doesn't happen, but I think it's probably more a case in that instance, I think, of a chief investment officer who has an awful lot of discretion for his department to say. I mean, you know, the management of Morgan Stanley will regard him as, you know, the boss in his own little fiefdom. And he's appointed to be, if you like, a responsible person in terms of ensuring that the research output from the firm is correct, honest, and all the rest of it. And remember, there are sort of, you know, there are, well, we used to call them Chinese walls between various departments. So I think I would rather assume, until there is hard evidence otherwise, that chief investment officer was actually producing something which he pretty much believed in. It may not have gone completely against the bank's proprietary positions, but I would have thought that we should assume that he has been fairly honest. I think as a result of that, the chief executive of Morgan Stanley might have had a phone call from the Fed saying that his research department is not being helpful. Now, I think that's quite likely. So, you know, and coming back to, you know, you used the phrase, you know, PsyOps and all the rest of it. This is all part of the information management, which I'm sure the Fed is, and the Fed and the US Treasury are going to be very, very keen to handle carefully. And I think that, I mean, it's rather like, if you remember back in, was it June last year, we had, Jamie Dimon stood up and said that the economic outlook has deteriorated. I said it was a storm, like a storm. Now I believe it's like a hurricane. And very shortly afterwards, I mean, it got a lot of publicity. Shortly afterwards, the chief economist at JP Morgan turned around and effectively wrote back on his remarks. And it was quite clear to me that someone from the Fed had rung up and said, look, you can't say this. You know, this is not helpful. So, yeah, we do get information managed, but I think it's probably less of the sort of conspiracy in the sense of a firm like, you know, one of the large banks trying to sort of gobble up its smaller banks. I would say that, I mean, if I was, say, someone like Jamie Dimon, you know, looking at this situation, I think I would rather be in the position that the Fed comes to me and says, we got a problem bank here. Can you help? Because then I can dictate the terms. So I think that's, you know, I don't see that it's really in any major bank's interest to just upset the apple cart, to try and gain advantage, if you like, by that sort of means. So I would discount that. I think it's far more a case of, you know, if the Fed wants us to help, then we will help. But obviously it'll be on our terms. If you see what I mean. And this is exactly what HSBC did with the Bank of England.
How about the flip side of that from the little man's perspective? When we hear these messages saying sell any rallies in the banks, don't go for these bear market rallies in the financial sector, would you in general think that that's actually decent advice for this, for ordinary and people who are, either have their deposits in banks or are holding bank stocks at this point?
Well, as I always say, I don't give investment advice. So the way I would put it is, you know, in my position, I take the view that we are on in the early stages of a continuing bear market. And the thing that drives it is not just a banking failure, but a currency failure. I mean, if the currency halves in its purchasing power, then you've got to ask yourself, what is the appropriate level of interest rates? Well, you know, it's like 100% or something, isn't it? And what does that do to financial asset values? Well, it kills them. Of course it does. So I don't see that we've got an end to rising interest rates. I don't see we've got an end to rising bond yields. And that being the case, even if this current hiatus in the banking system is smoothed over, there are going to be more hiatuses and there are going to be more crises along the way, because what we've come out of, in effect, is a massive bubble. And it's been a bubble which has been building ever since the 1980s, you know, on the back of declining interest rates. And it got to the stage, as we all know, that interest rates went to zero, a ridiculous proposition, and even negative. And it's still negative in Japan. I mean, it's absolutely crazy. It's such, you know, this is a bubble, and they're trying to sustain the bubble. And that's not going to work. And the problem is that if you have a bubble which is at the behest of government agencies, then they're going to just destroy their currencies, particularly since they have completely detached it from any real value in the form of gold coin or silver coin.
So that effect of destruction of the currencies, how does that affect ordinary people, workers, savers, retirees, and what can they do about it?
Well, it means that you know, from a worker's point of view, lots of businesses will go out of business because they cannot afford to pay the interest that goes with a collapsing currency. It will drive the whole economy into a depression. For some reason, I don't know why it is, but the Keynesians seem to think that it's either or. Either the economy is growing, in which case you've got inflation, or it's contracting, in which case you've got deflation. That's complete rubbish. It doesn't work like that. You've only got to observe what happens in every inflation, every hyperinflation, and you can see that a hyperinflation actually kills the economy. And that's the situation which I think everybody faces. So it's a combination. I mean, it's a combination of nastiness because on the one hand, you're losing your job. On the other hand, your savings are being completely trashed by rising interest rates. If you're looking at pensions and things like that, what's your pension going to buy? Nothing. If you're letting property, I mean, can you how do you keep pace with the falling purchasing power of your rent? You can't. It doesn't work like that. You fix rent and that stays for some time. And even though your property maintenance costs are rising, you can't jack up the rent every 5 minutes in order to index it, if you like. I mean, that's not how it works at all. The property market doesn't work like that. So, you're in all these areas, basically you lose. You lose out completely. The destruction of the purchasing power of the currency is a real tragedy for the ordinary person.
Let's zoom in one more moment before we leave this tragedy. And that is, you mentioned the value, the purchasing power of your pension payouts, or your, in the US, we might say Social Security or pension. If you've got a defined benefit program that's promising to pay you X dollars of currency per month or whatever, that the value of that just keeps shrinking and shrinking and shrinking until it becomes difficult, and it becomes painful, then it becomes an insult, and then it becomes desperate after that. But that's not, but wait, there's more. That it's not just the payout amounts becoming less valuable in the sense of their purchasing power, but isn't the solvency and the effectiveness of the ability of the issuing pension management or authority or whatever to even hold the ship together in jeopardy here if they can't make their coupon on what they need to be able to continue those payouts?
Yeah, there are sort of cross currents in this. I mean, if you've got, it depends how the pension fund is invested. If we're looking at a defined benefit pension fund, in other words, it's sort of tied to the rate of inflation say two-thirds of a final salary type scheme, that sort of thing, then a manager of that scheme has a real problem, certainly. On the one hand, he benefits from the higher nominal rates that investments in bonds will generate. But on the other hand, of course, the capital values of that fall. And what he will probably find is that the contributions coming in, which would normally keep the whole thing going, they start drying up as well. And so he has a problem that way. As far as the sort of undefined benefit, as it were, if I can call it that, type pension, then that pressure on the fund manager is less. But in all cases, the way in which pension fund managers have tried to square the circle is by moving investment from bonds into equities. And I think a conservatively managed pension fund would reckon that it has, say, 50% in bonds and 50% in equities. And if the equity side gets killed, the problem then is that you've got, and this is particularly the case with the defined benefit, there are companies that sponsor each scheme, or there may be a group of companies sponsoring each scheme. They're then asked to contribute to make up the difference, the actuarial losses. And are they in a position to do that? This idea of pension gives you long-term security and all the rest of it, I'm afraid, gets blown out of the water by these developments. It does actually depend on stable purchasing power of a currency, which is what we appear to be losing.
There's been some talk about an additional risk ongoing now to the banking system of these interest increases by the Fed, and I think you touched on that a few moments ago when you talk about how it will affect small business owners and employees. If they if it impacts the business operation, in fact, some large percentage, and I think we talked about this last time, zombie companies where they're barely making their payments as it was, and now with rising interest rates aren't going to be able to make their payments on their debt or secure new debt. So the failure, the default against existing obligations by those formerly zombie companies as they finally fall over, will how that impact the banking system in addition to the layoffs of all their employees?
Yeah, I mean, it absolutely. I mean, we're now talking about loan risk. We've been talking about, if you like, the risk that comes from falling prices investing in term duration bonds. Now we're talking about non-performing loans. I mean, obviously, initially, in the early stages of an increase in interest rates, banks managed to expand their margins. And we saw that, in 2022, bank profits rose very significantly, and the share prices along with it. Nobody really paid very much attention to the increase in the, the set aside for non-performing loans, which has happened. But that is definitely going to be a problem. And there is another problem. I mean, consumers, I think I'm right in saying that in both the UK and in America, something like 70% of salaried staff, or is it 80% of salaried staff, basically spend their entire salary, and they are relying on the money coming on payday, because their capacity to spend, feed the family, whatever, to pay the bills at the end of the month is zero. Literally, they rely on that money coming in. So when they lose their jobs, they've got nothing, absolutely nothing. The only thing they can get is help from the state, welfare benefits if they qualify, and that doesn't really pay very much. It's certainly a lot less than, or it should, a lot less than what you might earn. So this is it's not just the corporate side which is going to be bad. I mean, the bad debts that coming out of consumer lending, I think, is likely to increase very substantially as well.
Yet one more wave crashing against the failing dam of the banking system then as well. So people who have deposits in the bank, or people who are wanting to protect themselves from destruction of the currency, as you've described, or fragility and systemic risk in the banking system, what options are available for ordinary people to consider to shore up their, to reduce their risk and to shore up their resiliency in the face of those risks?
Well, we've fortunately seen the situation whereby the idea of a bail-in is now gone. So the Fed and the Treasury understand that they must ensure that pretty much every bank has got to be rescued one way or the other, and depositors protected. So if you're prepared to put your faith in the government or the FDIC, if you're less than $250,000. Anyway, then you perhaps don't need to worry too much. I mean, there may be the inconvenience, if you like, if a bank gets into difficulty and you've got, you can't take your money out until it's sorted. But this tends to be a weekend problem. I think this is why these crises appear to happen at weekends. Other than that, it does make sense, I think, to move your money into a large bank. If you can have a retail account in a large bank, then keep some liquidity there. But that's only within the fiat currency paradigm. Because the situation is so serious and it is so global, and this is just the first, as I said, act one of the tragedy, then I would say that you've really got to get out of the fiat currency system to the degree that you think is wise for your own personal circumstances. And the only way you can get out of the fiat currency system is twofold. Firstly, you buy something real, tangible, whatever. Or alternatively, if there's nothing there that floats your boat, then you go for the only form of circulating media which is truly money and is hoarded against this eventuality, and that is gold and silver. either in coin form or bullion form. And I would say that owning shares in an ETF or something is not good enough. It is not, because you only have a claim on gold or silver with the respective ETFs. You don't actually have gold or silver. You're in the same position as someone in the futures market trading, the GC, the gold future. You might have a claim on it, which you can in theory exercise, at the end of the future's life, but you don't have it. You don't own it. You've got counterparty risk instead. And so this is something which I'm very clear on. You have got to own physical gold, physical silver, and ensure that you hold it securely. Don't tell everybody, oh, I'm so clever. I've bought some gold and silver and I store it at home. Otherwise, you find some nasty people might come around and try and take it off you. Be sensible about it. This is something you're protecting yourself and your family and also your close friends, because they won't have protected themselves. And, none of us want to live in a society where, I'm all right, Jack. You didn't do anything tough. That is not a sort of society that I want to be involved with. And we are looking at a sort of post-apocalyptic situation, and we've got to think in that broader term. In my view, anyway.
Your comment is true about what do you really own? What do you really have legal title to? We have another guest who appears on our show, Rafi Farber. He made a valiant attempt to take delivery of a COMEX silver bar off of the COMEX. And went through this step after step after step, hurdle after hurdle, paperwork after paperwork, filing and registering and making sure all the T's were crossed and the I's were dotted. And in the end, he still didn't get his bar for one reason or another. It was just a nightmare and it dragged on forever. So if ordinary people think that that's their route to actually having their hands on something tangible, it's not the right way to go about it. It's been proven that for the little guy, there's other ways that you need to do to get your hands on owning something tangible and of intrinsic value. Just thinking about all that you've warned us about over the past couple of years coming to a head here, and it certainly seems like this was like a tremor at least, wondering if this is going to be the big one or if this is just a tremor to remind everybody that things are not well and that the officialdom, they have to scramble and create new extraordinary measures to try to keep duct taping and bungee cording the system to keep it from tumbling down. Anything that you think people need to keep their eyes on going forward, other than your interviews here, to keep kind of abreast of what's happening in the banking and currency markets?
Well, yes. I think there is another danger which is going to come and do exactly the opposite of what everybody expected, and that is the cryptocurrency situation. I thought ahead of this, I ought to look and see what the current capitalization of all the cryptocurrencies are. And so far as I can see, it's still over $1 trillion. Now, that is not just in America, that's spread around the world, admittedly, but American interests are probably a significant slug of that. You've got banks, you've got exchanges, you've got everything. I mean, that is not a small amount for people to lose. And that is another problem that I think that the authorities have in terms of trying to deal with. I mean, I think that they would quite like to see this cryptocurrency thing just disappear. And that might just color the way in which they handle cryptocurrency banks. I mean, for example, Signature. And there was also Silvergate, which is a sort of crypto type bank. I mean, these things are beginning to fall apart. And I think that could well color the way the authorities deal with these banking collapses. I wouldn't for one moment see a combination of Silvergate and Signature as being the equivalent of a Lehman, as it were. But I mean, we could be talking about some fairly significant sums being lost within that cryptocurrency world. And also the other thing is that the stable coins, nobody has, to my satisfaction, answered, what actually backs these stable coins? And I saw, I mean, I don't think Tether has ever been audited. And so on that basis, you know, I would think, well, if there is a deficiency there, then that's another real area of risk. I mean, in the broader sense, when you start having the financial system beginning to fall over, you'll find that all sorts of things happen out of the blue. And I suspect that this cryptocurrency world is going to be very, very dangerous. I can see that being literally kiboshed completely. So I think that's another area where I hope people haven't been too misled into the idea of thinking that Bitcoin is the new gold and whatever, whatever. I don't care about Bitcoin. All I know is that it can't be legally money. And also, it is at the center of a completely... well, corrupt, I think, is probably not too strong a word, system, which is beyond regulation. I'm not saying that regulation is a good thing, but what has happened is that, you know, these are people who have deliberately set themselves up outside regulation, and you have to ask why. You have to ask what are the risks. And when you find that a stable coin like Tether refuses to have itself properly audited, that to me is a major warning signal. It really is. So I think that's another area I would say, you know, stay clear of completely would be my view. I'm not involved with it at all. I know there are lots of people who swear by it, etc. And, you know, they run, you know, wonderful charts and all the rest of it, showing relationships, da 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 da. I would rather not be involved.
If people want to follow your work, which you publish multiple times on a weekly basis, where should they get connected?
Well, goldmoney.com, and I write a research paper once a week, published on Thursdays. The one I'm doing at the moment is actually about this credit thing, so people who see this video might want to go and sort of have a look at that. I write a market report, which goes on out on Friday. And those are the two principal things that I do. You know, I look forward to seeing you on our website.
Excellent, Alistair. And if anybody who's watching this wants to make sure they don't miss a single interview with Alistair or any of our guests in these very eventful times, make sure you sign up for our free newsletter so you won't miss a single episode. Go to libertyandfinance.com, put in your name, your email address, click submit, make sure you confirm on the confirming email, and you'll get one email in your inbox per day. We don't share your email address with anybody. And you, in that daily email, you'll see our latest interview with our latest guest, including Alistair, and any of our weekly specials. Make sure you go to libertyandfinance.com. It's all free. Thank you, Alistair, for joining us on behalf of all of our viewers here on Liberty and Finance.
That's very much my pleasure, DK. Thank you for having me.
Miles Franklin Precious Metals is one of America's oldest and most trusted bullion dealers. Miles Franklin is A-plus rated and accredited by the Better Business Bureau, licensed and bonded, and has zero complaints ever registered. Here at Liberty and Finance, we are licensed brokers with Miles Franklin. To order, simply call us, discuss your needs, and we can let you know our live inventory, prices, and availability, and lock in your order over the phone. Once your order is locked, the price is held for you regardless of market fluctuations, and the metals are reserved for you awaiting your settled payment. Within one business day of ordering, you will receive an email invoice detailing the order and payment instructions. Miles Franklin accepts payments by bank wire, ACH or electronic check, money order, check mailed priority mail, and cryptocurrency. The fastest forms of payment are bank wire and cryptocurrency. Upon settled payment, metals will ship out within 3 to 5 business days. You will receive tracking information via email. Domestic shipping charges are $15 for any order under 500 ounces of silver or 10 ounces of gold. For orders larger than that, domestic shipping is free. The package will be boxed, fully insured, and labeled discreetly, with no indication of the contents inside. For your privacy, the name Miles Franklin will not even be on the package. To talk to myself, Kaiser, my brother Elijah, or my father Dunnigan, call 1-888-81-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-815-4237.